Welcome to Running Scared. I'm Coach Christine. I'm a level 2 RRCA and a Run Walk Run certified coach. And if you enjoy a bit of true crime along with running, walking, or you're willing to get laced up to get in a good workout session, then welcome. You have found your corner of the internet and we are likely going to be fast friends. Let's go ahead and get right into today's workout with a walking warm-up in 3, 2, and 1. Now, friends, if you have run with me before, you know that I like to use this warm-up to go over some housekeeping notes, give you some good mindful form cues. And if you haven't, if this is your first time here along with me, welcome along, friends. That's exactly what we do here for this warm-up. So first, out of the gate, let's be intentional with our form. We're nice and tall. We're staying relaxed by keeping those shoulders down and back and staying light on our feet. We're going to do that throughout today's workout in case, and I'll give you those reminders here and now while we're going through today's case as well. Now, if you're outdoors, you're listening to a true crime case, so I know you're going to be very mindful and aware of your surroundings. It's always a good idea that you let someone that you love and trust know where you're going to be, or at least when to expect you back at home if you're outdoors. And if you're inside on a treadmill, let's go ahead and bring that incline up to at least a 1%. That's going to help to minimize the impact on our joints. If you're rolling through here, maybe on a stair stepper, elliptical, any other kind of cardio machine, be mindful of your form as well, engaging your core and making sure that you're not leaning over that display or holding on to those handrails. I know I've been guilty of that myself at times, so let's just take in this opportunity to be the best that we could possibly be throughout today's workout. Now, friends, this is the final bonus episode for the Murder, Mayhem, and Miles Challenge. During this challenge, we've covered Lizzie Borden, Jolly Jane, an Angel of Death, and the Salem Witch Trials. And we also got an awesome recap as our first bonus episode with a fellow challenge participant. I'm going to link all of those in episode notes if you want to recap or go back and listen to any of the cases. I do want to take this opportunity to also give a big congratulations to all the participants. Absolutely amazing work. You guys crushed this challenge. We also had some really fun prizes giveaways, and I also want to give a big shout out to our week 4 and grand prize winners for, again, such a fun, awesome, well work done. Now, today's episode is going to take a small detour from the mistresses of murder and mayhem, because instead of focusing on the mistresses, we're going to focus on the abject terror experienced by the residents of Boston in the early 1960s at the hand of the Boston Strangler. And before I get too much further into this case, I'm going to warn you right out of the gate, I have not covered a case this terrifying to me personally since the Toy Box Killer. It's taken me days and weeks to do research on this because many times it becomes so intense that I have to actually walk away from it, take a break from it. Therefore, for the sake of you getting in the best workout possible, I'm not going to do a full deep dive into the details that I've found out there in the interwebs, but I will point you in the direction of an incredibly well-done investigative journalism full 12-part podcast series. I'm linking that in episode notes as well, because today's, my friend, I'm going to do this kind of like as a runner's digest. Get it? A little bit of reader's digest version of this case. However, I can't leave out the whole premise, so I'm going to give you some warnings that this case is going to cover person or persons that were seeking out women to sexually assault, rape, terrorize, and kill them in ways that I wish no one would ever have to experience. And it's also important to note that while I like to usually cover cases that we can say with certainty, that mofo definitely did it, and luckily that individual's been arrested, apprehended, or otherwise we can say case closed, well, today's not that type of case either, because honestly, I still don't know how I feel about whether or not the individual credited as being the Boston Strangler was actually the sole killer of these victims. So the jury's out for me personally. Now, if you're thinking, I don't want to listen to this kind of case, it sounds a little too intense for me, I get it. I totally do. I have lighter cases that you can check out, including some of my really great recent conversations with awesome women from Kira, your fellow Murder, Mayhem, and Mileage Challenge participant to Christine and Eden of the Uncluttered and Unfiltered podcast, and of course, Colleen of the Wellness Witch Tarot podcast. So I'll link those again in case you might want to bow out of this particular workout until a later time. However, I saw some of the memes that y'all have been posting in our Facebook community page, so I think that you're going to be just fine listening to this case. Great work, my friends, as we're rolling on through here. We're about to kick off this workout, so let's get right into what you can expect for the actual workout. We're going to use the RPE scale, 1 to 10, 1 being a stroll, 10 being an all-out sprint. We're going to hang out in conversation blocks, about 8 to 10 minutes in length for those conversation blocks, which means an RPE scale of 3 to 5. And then we're going to have 2-minute pace changes in between. You could either pull back during those pace changes into a recovery or push it up a notch. I think you're going to have a lot of extra adrenaline from this particular case. So I'm going to recommend you go ahead and push it up into like a tempo pace, which is about an RPE of 5, 6, 7. Give yourself a little bit of that test and speed up those legs. And again, if you're on an incline or treadmill, or you have an elliptical, something of that sort, you can always change the pace during those pace changes with a little bit of the bump up on your incline or resistance. Now let's get right into today's case and workout with our first conversation block in 3, 2, and 1. Now the Boston Strangler is considered America's first serial killer of the modern era, because of course there had been serial killers before, but by the 1960s, when this individual or individuals came into play, mass market television, radio, and newspapers had appeared on the scene, and they had seized on the Boston Strangler phenomenon and created widespread panic. Because between June 14th of 1962 and January 4th of 1964, 13 single women between the ages of 19 and 85 were murdered in the Boston area. Most, as I mentioned before, were sexually assaulted and strangled in their apartments. Police believed, well, the jury was kind of out with police force. Some of them believed that there was just one man that was the perpetrator. Others thought that maybe there were some copycats going on, but there were a few similarities in all of these cases. There were no signs of forced entry into the homes of any of the women. So there's an assumption that the women either let the assailant in because they thought that they knew him, or they believed him to be an apartment maintenance man, a delivery man, or some other kind of serviceman. Another interesting thing is that the attacks continued despite extensive media publicity after the first few murders. And while many residents of that area went out and they purchased tear gas, locks, deadbolts for their doors, some women even moved out of the area. I can tell you that I probably would have been one of those women. I would have definitely had a new zip code. The murders occurred in several cities, including Boston proper, complicating the jurisdictional oversight for prosecution of the crimes. Massachusetts Attorney General Edward W. Brooke helped to coordinate the various police forces. And again, as I mentioned, the police were kind of not sure. Some were thinking that maybe there were the actions of more than one person was involved, but the public believed that it was definitely just one individual, likely because that's how the media had portrayed it to be. There was a couple of connections potentially as well, especially because the majority of the victims, as I mentioned earlier, had allowed this assailant into their home, and also some of them had connections to the local hospitals in the area. But what was especially terrifying to the residents of Boston during that time was the Strangler's victims were not ladies of the night, they weren't prostitutes, they weren't vagrants, they weren't drug addicts, they were respectable women, and they ranged from young to middle-aged to elderly women, and they were attacked in what could be foreseen as the safety of their own homes. So this created a sense in the public that no woman was safe during this time. And this case has a plethora of information, friends. But one of the biggest reasons why it holds so much controversy is that, as any true crime aficionado knows, is that most serial killers have a victim profile. Lots of commonalities in their victims that they choose. Well, this series of murders truly had some big disparities in the victims and how they met their demise in the last hours on Earth. So we're gonna start this off with the first set of victims, and they're categorized as the older ladies or older women. I want to take a quick second to point out that as a woman herself in her 40s, I find this category of women to be, well, a little misleading because it's anywhere from their early 50s to late 80s. But alas, that's how they've been grouped. So let's get into it a little bit more. Of the official Boston stranglings, 6 of the victims were between the ages of 55 and 75. 2 possible additional victims were 85 and 69 years of age. The remaining 5 victims were considerably younger, ranging in ages from 19 to 23. The first of these victims was Anna E. Slessers, a seamstress living on her own. More than a decade earlier, she had fled Latvia with her son and daughter, and she had settled into a small apartment in a quiet, old-fashioned neighborhood in the Back Bay area of Boston. On the evening of June 14, 1962, she had finished her dinner, and she had just enough time to take a quick bath before her son, Juris, was expected to come pick her up for a Latvian memorial service at their church that they were attending that night. So in her robe, she went into the bathroom, she turned on the water, she was listening to the inspiring strains of some of her favorite opera music, and just before 7 o'clock, Juris knocked at his mother's door. He knocked and there was no answer. When he tried the door handle, it was locked. He started to get annoyed because he knew his mom was expecting him and she should have been outside waiting for him to pull up. He didn't even want to take his mother to services in the first place. So he started to pound on the door. But then he started to get a little worried. Was she sick? Perhaps did maybe she fall when she was inside? Or even worse, he started to get a little gnawing feeling in his gut where she sounded so depressed lately. And on the phone, even the night before, she sounded so sad. So he was worried that maybe she had even hurt herself. He started to throw his weight against the door, and luckily it did open. But unfortunately, his worst fears were confirmed when he saw her lying in the bathroom with the cord from her robe around her neck. He telephoned the police, and then he called his sister in Maryland to tell her about what he thought was the tragic suicide of their mother. Gerald Frank in The Boston Strangler describes how homicide detectives James Mellon and John Driscoll found her. Detective Mellon goes on to say that his first sight of Anna Slessor's body was shocking. She was startling nude. She had been positioned in a way that exposed her in a very just, it felt unsafe to him. It felt disturbing. She had been outstretched, wearing her blue taffeta house cut with a red lining, but it had been spread completely apart in front so that from shoulders down she was nude and her body had been, as I mentioned, posed. The apartment was made to look as though it had been ransacked, but despite this attempt to make the scene look like a robbery, a gold watch and other pieces of jewelry were left untouched. Anna had been strangled with a cord from her own robe, which had been tied around her neck so tightly and then also tightened into a bow. Now, she showed evidence of sexual assault and trauma with some unknown object. Police assumed that the crime had started out as a burglary, and that when the burglar saw the woman in her robe, that he was overcome by some uncontrollable urge to take her, and that he killed her afterwards to avoid being recognized. Now, that seems a little far-fetched, but again, this was the first of many to come, and they did start coming because just a couple of weeks later, on June 30th, 68-year-old Nina Nichols was murdered in her apartment in the Brighton area of Boston. The apartment looked like it had been burglarized. Every door had been pulled open. Possessions lay scattered around wildly on the floor as though a tornado had ripped through it. But oddly enough, one open drawer revealed a set of sterling silver that had been left completely untouched, as were the dollars that she had in her purse and her expensive camera and the watch on her wrist. The killer had gone through her address book and her mail for some unknown reason. Later, it was determined that nothing had been taken. The chaos of disorder, the ransacking, was just for show. Now, friends, let's go ahead and take that pace change here. You can either pull it back or pop it up a notch in 3, 2, and 1. 2 minutes here, and this gives you the perfect opportunity to just check in on your form. Making sure that you're still staying nice and tall and you're engaging your core. If you're pushing it up a notch, I want you to be mindful of those feet You want them landing underneath your hips. And if you're pulling it back, this is a great time to kind of shake out any tension that could build up during the workout or as you listen through this case. While we're waiting to get back into our next conversation pace segment, let's learn a little bit more. They did notice that the killer had gone through Nina's address book and her mail for some unknown reason, and later it was determined that nothing had been taken. So again, that chaos of disorder, it was just all for show. She was found with her legs spread, her house coat and slip pulled up to her waist, tied tightly around her neck, or two of her own nylon stockings, with the ends tied again, ludicrously, in a bow. She too had been sexually assaulted, and blood had been found inside of her. The time of death was estimated to be around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She was a retired physiotherapist, and she had led a very quiet and modest life. She had been widowed for 2 decades. She had no male friends except for her brother-in-law. Now, what's interesting is that very same day, about 15 miles north of Boston in the suburb of Lynn, Helen and Blake met a similar death sometime between the times of 8 and 10, so earlier in the day. The 65-year-old divorcee had been strangled with one of her nylons. Her brassiere had been looped around her neck over the stockings and tied into a bow. Friends, let's take it back into that next conversation block in 3, 2, and 1. And while we're here, learn that again, unfortunately, Helen's body also showed signs of sexual assault and penetration. But again, there was no trace of sperm. She was found lying face down, nude on her bed with her legs spread apart. Her apartment also had been thoroughly ransacked, and it appeared as though 2 diamond rings that Helen wore had been pulled off from her fingers and taken. The killer had tried unsuccessfully to open a metal strongbox and a footlocker. Police Commissioner Edmund McNamara, McNamara was very alarmed. A warning went out to women in the Boston area to lock all of their doors and be wary of strangers. He canceled all police vacations and transferred all detectives to work for homicide. He was definitely thinking they had to get to the end of this. A thorough investigation began of all known sex offenders and violent former mental patients. They were looking for a crazed madman, one that probably attacked older women because of maybe some hatred of his mother. A former FBI man, McNamara, called on the Bureau to ask him to hold a seminar for his 50 best detectives on the topic of sex crimes. Now, it doesn't end there, my friends, because of course, as we know, on August 19th, 75-year-old Ida Erga, a very shy and retiring widow, fell victim to the strangler. She was found 2 days later in her apartment at 7 Grove Avenue in the Boston's West End. As in the other deaths, there were no signs of forced entry. Whoever killed her, she had probably let in voluntarily. Police Sergeant James McDonald described how he found her. Goes on to say that upon entering the apartment, the officers observed the body of Ida Erga lying on her back on the living room floor, wearing a light brown nightdress, which was torn, completely exposing her body. There was a white pillowcase knotted tightly around her neck, and again, we found that the victim had been posed in an obscene way, purposefully at the entrance of the door so that she would be found in a really vulnerable position by whomever entered. And let's just say that while she too was sexually assaulted, they did not find sperm. But the police did withhold the details of the vicious attack to the press because, well, friends, as I too am going to withhold the details, it was not pretty. Within 24 hours of Ida Erga's murder, a 67-year-old nurse named Jane Sullivan was killed in her apartment in Dorchester, across town from where Ida lived. She had been dead for about 10 days before she was found. Police had found her on her knees in her bathtub with her feet up and over the back of the tub and her head underneath the faucet. She too had been strangled by one of her own nylons, probably in the kitchen bedroom or hall where blood was found on the floors. She may have been sexually assaulted, but because the corpse was in that state for so long with water, it was badly decomposed and they could not determine. However, there were some bloodstains on the handle of a broom, so they're thinking that likely she was assaulted with that object. There was no sign of forcible entry, nor was the apartment ransacked, even though Jane's purse was found open. And this is when I say, my friends, oh, hell to the nah, I am definitely moving out of Boston because there is just no way you're going to see me there. So, of course, I think it's very, very understandable if folks were feeling the absolute terror of who would be next. This is when women started to, they were deadbolting their locks. They were talking to their neighbors, trying to keep each other as safe as possible. During this time, we're going to start learning about what the younger ladies or younger women that were killed during this time. This case continues to get a bit more graphic. I'm gonna let you know that right now, and I'm doing my best to not give you a lot of those details, but whomever this individual was or individuals were, they did become a bit more bold with their murders. Now, we go on to learn about the younger women, the younger ladies. Boston did get about a 3-month reprieve, which gave the police a chance to check out absolutely everyone they wanted to check out. Nothing much came, though, of this flurry of diligent activity, except a long list of people who were probably not the strangler. But that vacation, that reprieve, ended December 5th, 1962, when Sophie Clark, a popular and attractive 21-year-old African-American student at the Carnegie Institute of Medical Technology, was found by her two roommates. The apartment Sophie shared was in the Back Bay area, a couple of blocks away from Anna Slessor's, the first victim's apartment. Sophie lay nude with her legs spread wide apart in the living room, strangled by three of her own nylon stockings, which had been knotted and tied very tightly around her neck. Her half slip had also been tied around her neck. There was evidence of sexual assault, and semen was found on the rug near her body. So we see a very big departure here from the general modus operandi, the MO from the previous category of victims. Not only was she vastly younger than the others, she was a different race. And this crime scene was the first to have left behind bodily fluids of the killer. Now, while there were no signs of forcible entry, we do know that Sophie was very security conscious and she insisted on having a second lock on the apartment door. She had told her family and friends that she was actually very scared of this Boston Strangler. She was cautious. She even questioned her friends that came to the door before she let them in. So how she was able to get convinced to let this killer in, we're likely never going to know. However, we do know that Sophie did not go down without a fight. She kicked some major ass. And that's also likely why it was able to provide a lot of evidence. She scratched up the assailant to fend him off. That's maybe why there was some DNA left behind. But again, the killer had rummaged through the drawers in the apartment and had examined her collection of classical records. Sophie had been writing a letter to her boyfriend when she was interrupted, probably by the strangler. She did not date anyone in the Boston area and was very reserved with the opposite sex. When police questioned the neighbors, Mrs. Marcella Luca, who lived in the same building, mentioned that around 2:30 that afternoon, a man had knocked on her door and said that the super had sent him to see about painting her apartment. He then told her that he'd have to fix her bathroom ceiling and complimented her on her figure. And he said, "Have you ever thought of modeling?" he asked her. She put her finger to her lips to quiet him down, kind of shush him down. And she said the man became angry. His character seemed to change completely because she said to him, "Shh, my husband is sleeping in the next room." He then said, "Oh, I have the wrong apartment," and he left hurriedly. She described him as being between 25 and 30 years old, of average height, with honey-colored hair, and wearing a dark jacket and dark green trousers. Was this the Boston Strangler? Likely, since the building superintendent had not dispatched anyone to check on tenants that day. Also, 2:30 in the afternoon was approximately the time that Sophie Clark had been murdered. Friends, we're about that 8-minute mark, but I'm going to let you keep pushing through this conversation pace for about another 60 seconds, because we're going to learn a little bit more about 3 weeks later when 23-year-old Patricia Bissett, a secretary for a Boston engineering firm, was discovered on Monday, December 31st, that's right, New Year's Eve, 1962. When her boss became worried about her, he went to her apartment that morning to pick her up for work, but she had not answered the door. When she never arrived at work, he went to her apartment building in the Back Bay area, in which, again, Anna Slessers and Sophie Clark had lived. Her apartment was locked, so her boss, with the help of the custodian, climbed through a window into the apartment. They found her in a face up in bed with the covers drawn up to her chin, looking like she was taking a nap. Underneath the covers, she lay there with several stockings knotted and interwoven, with a blouse tied tightly around her neck. There's evidence of recent sexual intercourse, and she was, unfortunately, had been in the early stages of pregnancy. Friends, let's go ahead and do that pace change here. You can either pull it back in 3, 2, and 1, or push up a notch. I'm going to ask you, though, do you think this is the time where you would be like, are you moving? Are you opening the door for anyone? I'm not sure if maybe in, I did not find any kind of records of this when I was doing this research, but I am really curious if maybe the individual that came to their door potentially may have scared them by saying, I'm here, maybe perpetrating as like a law enforcement officer, letting them know it was a routine kind of a check-in. Again, didn't find any evidence of that sort, but I'm very surprised that these women, during this time when this case was so in everywhere that they turned, would be opening the doors for maintenance man. Now, we're going to learn that things did get quiet again for a couple of months, and then the police again took this as an opportunity to backtrack and start looking for any clues that would link these people together. Any person that may have known of all of the victims, any place that maybe all of them visited or shopped, something to link where this individual that was attacking them may have been. And again, we see the killer switch his MO as the next victim was found in early March of 1963, 25 miles north of Boston in Lawrence. 68-year-old Mary Brown was found beaten to death in her apartment. She also had been strangled and raped. It's definitely where I would start thinking that it's different individuals. The murder scene then moved back to Boston 2 months later. On Wednesday, May 8th of 1963, Beverly Simmons, a pretty 23-year-old graduate student, missed choir practice at the Second Unitarian Church in Back Bay. Her friend went to her apartment and opened it with a key that she had given to him. We'll learn more about what he saw when he opened up that door as we take it back into our next conversation pace in 3, 2, and 1. As we roll back into that segment, I want you to check in with your form again, making sure you're still staying tall, engaging your core. I'm sure, friend, that you're probably not going to be surprised that unfortunately when he opened the door, he found that Beverly was posed directly in front of that open door on a sofa bed. Her legs had been spread apart. Her hands had been tied behind her with one of her scarves in a nylon stocking, and two handkerchiefs tied together were tied and knotted around her neck. Over her mouth, a cloth had been placed, and under it, a second cloth had been stuffed into her mouth. While it appeared that Beverly had been strangled, she had in fact been killed by 4 stab wounds to her throat. She had sustained 22 stab wounds in all, 18 of which were in a bull's eye design on her left breast. Ligature around her neck was decorative and not tied tightly enough to actually strangle her. The bloody knife was found in her kitchen sink, and she had not been raped by man or object, nor was there any sperm present in her body. It was estimated she had been dead approximately 48 to 72 hours and probably had been killed between late Sunday evening or Monday morning. She was studying to be an opera singer and had planned to try out for the Met in New York just that year. Police speculated that because of her singing, she had developed very strong throat muscles, and that may have made strangulation more difficult and resulted in why she was stabbed to death. Okay, now we start to see the police are getting positively desperate. I mean, so much so that they're thinking, we're going to do whatever it takes to get to the bottom of this. And friends, that's indeed what they did. They literally got so desperate that they actually turned to an individual, an ad copywriter named Paul Gordon, who claimed to have special ESP qualities. He claimed that he knew who the strangler was and what he looked like. The police were more than normally receptive to this untraditional approach because, again, they were desperate. So Paul began his description of the man who killed Anna Slessors. He described this man as a fairly tall, with bony hands, pale white skin, red bony knuckles, and he said that his eyes were hollow set. He's got a tooth missing in the upper right-hand corner. He went on to say that this strangler was kind of in some hospital, that his ESP was telling him that he was in some kind of a home, but that he could walk about, or that he did a lot of sitting on a bench outside of the actual residency area, that he was on some kind of grounds. He went on to describe this individual, saying he's got many problems. I see that he used to beat up his mother cruelly. The family comes from Maine or Vermont. He's terribly lonely. He likes to wander the street watching women. He's trying to get as close to them as possible because he's trying to find his mother, but he can't because she's deceased. I mean, he was super elaborate. One of the detectives brought out a number of photos of men who had been caught mugging or breaking and entering into the buildings in the Back Bay area, and Gordon identified one of them, an Arnold Wallace, and he's like, that's your strangler. He had matched the description that Gordon had given them just earlier. Well, Wallace was a 26-year-old mental patient at Boston State Hospital who had what they call ground privileges, meaning he could leave. He didn't have to stay inside of the residency the entire time. A few days earlier, he had wandered away and he was sleeping in the basement of an apartment house. He was violent and he had beaten his mother on occasion. Then Gordon switched to the murder of Sophie Clark. He went on to describe her apartment with incredible detail, as though he had been there, which my spidey sense is saying, like, I don't know about this guy. The killer, according to Gordon, said was a large, husky black man, and he said that this individual was somebody that Sophie knew. The detectives were flabbergasted by the detail in which he described the apartment. And not only that, but Lewis Barnett was somebody who fit Gordon's description perfectly, was actually a suspect in Sophie's murder. He had dated her on and off, and it was possible she would have let him into her apartment. Gordon also said the strangler would identify himself soon and that he would confess. He goes on to say, and when this fellow confesses, it's going to be like a big carpet rolled out in front of you, and all the answers will be so simple, you'll kick yourself for months at a time that you couldn't see it. When the police went out to check on Arnold Wallace, they found out that he had escaped the hospital 5 or 6 times, and those hospital escapes seemed to coincide with the strangling deaths. Gordon also went to the hospital so that he could see Arnold Wallace in the flesh. And then he went and said, he's the man, Gordon told the police positively. The police decided they were going to look into Gordon's activities before they went any further with Arnold Wallace. And this is when they found that Gordon had been to that hospital before he talked to the police. So it's possible he saw Arnold on the grounds and described him. Maybe it was a hoax. Maybe Gordon was the strangler. Because Arnold, whose IQ was between 60 and 70, was given a lie detector test, but his low intelligence and his inability to distinguish between fantasy and reality made communication difficult. The test was inconclusive. He was taken back to the hospital while police tried to check out all the circumstantial evidence. There was yet another quiet period during the summer of 1963. June, July, and August passed without another strangling. But then on September 8th, 1963, in Salem, Evelyn Corbin, a pretty 58-year-old divorcee who passed herself off as more than a decade younger, was found murdered. She had been strangled with two of her nylon stockings. She lay across the bed, face up and nude. Her underpants had been stuffed into her mouth as a gag. And around the bed were lipstick-marked tissues that had traces of semen as well. There's a lot of sperm found on this particular crime scene. Her locked apartment had been searched, but apparently nothing was stolen. A tray of jewelry had been put on the floor, and her purse had been emptied onto the sofa. One strange clue could not be explained. Outside her window was the fire escape, was a fresh donut, which was not deposited or thrown there by anyone in the building. I don't know why that would be a clue. To be honest, it just sounds so bizarre, like it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever, but alas, again, I'm just reporting that there was a donut there, my friends, and they considered it a clue. On November 25th, the Boston area was still grieving for the loss of their beloved President JFK, who had been assassinated 3 days earlier. And while most Americans had stayed numbly glued to their television sets, Joanne Graff was raped and murdered in her ransacked Lawrence apartment. This very conservative and religious 23-year-old industrial designer had died shortly before the president. Two nylon stockings had been tied in an elaborate bow around her neck. There were teeth marks on her breast. At 3:25 p.m., the student that lived above her heard footsteps in the hall. His wife had been concerned someone had been sneaking around in the hallways, so he went to the door and listened. When he heard a knock on the door of the apartment opposite his, the student opened his door to find a man about 27 with pomaded hair, dressed in dark green slacks and a dark shirt and jacket, and he said, "Does Joan Graff live here?" he asked, mispronouncing Joanne's name. The student told him that Joanne lived on the floor below the apartment at which he was knocking. Moments later, he heard the door open and shut on the floor beneath him and assumed that Joanne had let the man in on her apartment. 10 minutes later, a friend telephoned Joanne, but there was no answer. Friends, again, we're still in the middle of all of this Boston Strangler being, like, on the news. Why are people not more hesitant to give out information? Well, anyway, the morning before Joanne's death, in the apartment down the hall from Joanne's, a woman heard someone outside her door. She saw a piece of paper being slipped under her door. She watched mesmerized as it was being moved from side to side soundlessly. Then suddenly the paper vanished and she heard footsteps. Does that not creep you out? Because that totally creeps me out. A little over a month later, on January 4th, 1964, two young women came home after work to their apartment at 44A Charles Street. And unfortunately, they found their new roommate, 19-year-old Mary Sullivan, murdered in, again, very grotesque and shocking fashion. Like the other victims, she had been strangled, first with a dark stocking, over the stocking, a pink silk scarf tied with a huge bow under her chin, and over that, another pink and white flowered scarf. A bright, happy New Year's card had been placed against her feet. It does get worse. She was found in a sitting position on the bed with her back against the headboard, and I'm going to spare you details from there. Unfortunately, let's just say this individual was very sick. The only positive that came from what this individual did is that he did leave a lot of DNA. A couple of weeks after the murder of Mary Sullivan, Massachusetts Attorney General Edward Brooke took over. On January 17th, 1964, highest-ranking law enforcement officer in the state made this case his own, showing the city that it was his topmost priority. We'll learn more about that here as we have that two-minute pace change, and then we're going to ease back into our cool-down. So in 3, 2, 1, take it into your pace change, my friends. Now, Attorney General Edward Brooke meant no disrespect for the Boston police, but this was an unusual case because it spanned those 5 police jurisdictions. The group that Brooke put together would coordinate the activities of various police departments. There would also be permanent staff assigned to the Strangler, and they weren't going to be pulled off to go work any other jobs. It was essentially the Strangler's Bureau is what this was created as. Furthermore, Brooke's task force could mollify the newspapers because 2 women reported as Jean Cole and Loretta McLaughlin. For the record, American had made a crusade out of exposing the Boston Police Department's mistakes, charging them with extreme inefficiency. To head up this task force, he called the Special Division of Crime Research and Detection. He selected a close friend, the Assistant Attorney General, John S. Bottomley. I will tell you, friends, that some people were not big fans of Assistant Attorney General Bottomley. But Bottomley's top team consisted of Boston Police Department's Detective Philip DiNatale, Special Officer James Mellon, Metropolitan Police Stephen Delaney, and State Police Detective Lieutenant Andrew Tooney. They also had Dr. Donald Kneffig heading up the Medical Psychiatric Advisory Committee. Several well-known experts in forensic medicine. 2 months later, they had Governor Peabody offer a $10,000 reward to any person furnishing information leading to the arrest and conviction of the persons or person who had committed the murders of the 11 official victims of the Strangler. The Strangler Bureau had several major pieces of business before it could hit the ground running. It had to collect, organize, and assimilate over 37,000 pages of material from the various police departments that had been involved in the case. And there was concerns again that maybe there were some copycat murders. They had a hard time making that distinction, because what kind of person would be capable of such murders? Dr. Kniff goes on to give them some information about what he expected from a forensic psychiatric point of view. Let's pull it back into our cool down in 3, 2, and 1. So this individual is likely around 30 years old, probably a good deal older. He's neat, orderly, and punctual. He either works with his hands or has a hobby involving handiwork. He is most probably single, separated, or divorced, and he would not impress the average observer as crazy. He has no close friends of either sex. And then he also, bottomly, decided to bring in a individual by the name of Peter Horkos, a well-known Dutch psychic. Unfortunately, that would not go really well as how people perceived the Strangler's Bureau, because this individual, Horkos, did identify a suspect, but the individual was definitively found to not be the Strangler. On October 27, 1964, a stranger entered a young woman's home posing as a detective. He tied the victim to her bed, sexually assaulted her, and suddenly left saying, "I'm sorry," as he went. The woman's description of her attacker led police to identify the assailant as DeSalvo. When his photo was published, many women identified him as the man who had assaulted them. Earlier on October 27th, DeSalvo had posed as a motorist with car trouble and attempted to enter a home in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. The homeowner, future Brockton Police Chief Richard Sprawls, became suspicious and eventually fired a shotgun at DeSalvo. Now, DeSalvo was not initially suspected of being involved in the strangling murders, because in addition to strangler murders at that time, the police were also trying to solve a series of rapes committed by a man who had been dubbed as the Measuring Man or the Green Man. They were certain that Albert was the man for those cases, but after he was charged with rape, he gave a detailed confession of his activities as the Boston Strangler. He initially confessed to a fellow inmate, George Nassar. Nassar reported the confession to his attorney, F. Lee Bailey. Yes, F. Lee Bailey, one of the individuals of the OJ Dream Team defense. F. Lee Bailey took on the defense of DeSalvo. He also took that confession, and the police were incredibly impressed by the accuracy of DeSalvo's descriptions of the crime scenes. There were some inconsistencies, but DeSalvo was able to cite details that had been withheld from the public. Bailey goes on to say in his 1971 book, That the Defense Never Rests, that DeSalvo got one detail right that even one of his victims was wrong about, because DeSalvo described a blue chair in the woman's living room, and she stated that it was brown. Photographic evidence proved DeSalvo was correct. No physical evidence substantiated his confession. Because of that, he was tried on charges for earlier, unrelated crimes of robbery and sexual offenses. He did become known as the Green Man and the Measuring Man, respectively. Now, friends, though we see that Albert had quite a few details correct and confessed fully, again, there was no physical evidence to substantiate his confession. But when he stood trial for those earlier unrelated crimes of robbery and sexual offenses, his attorney, F. Lee Bailey, brought up the confession to the murders as part of his client's history at the trial as a part of an insanity defense, but that was ruled inadmissible by the judge. He was sentenced to life imprisonment in 1967. And while DeSalvo goes off to prison to start serving his time, we're going to take a stroll down memory lane and learn a little bit about him. Albert was born in Chelsea, Massachusetts to Frank and Charlotte DeSalvo. His father was a violent alcoholic who at one point knocked out all of his wife's teeth and bent her fingers back until they broke in front of their children. Yes, absolutely horrible. He would also bring home prostitutes and engage in sexual acts with them in front of his wife and his young children. Albert witnessed all of this. Young DeSalvo then starts begin torturing animals as a child. He starts shoplifting, acting out, stealing. He's getting in trouble with the law. And in November 1943, at 12 years of age, Albert DeSalvo was first arrested for battery and robbery. In December of the same year, he was sent to Lyman School for Boys. In October 1944, he was paroled and started working as a delivery boy. Around this time, he was also subject to the neighbor that engaged in rampant sexual behavior in almost an exhibitionist kind of way. Now, this individual didn't molest or accost Albert, but Albert was privy to seeing these kind of sexual acts. And this may have led to furthering his violent and rampant sexual proclivities later in life. On August 46, he returned to Lyman School for stealing an automobile. And before he completed his second sentence, Albert joined the U.S. Army. He was honorably discharged after his first tour of duty. He met his wife, and he did re-enlist, and then again was honorably discharged. His wife and him moved back to the States, and she goes on to say that he had an absolutely voracious sexual appetite, that many times she wasn't able to keep up with his requests, and he went on later to say that he felt a burning within that could only be released sexually. After his honorable discharge, when he went back to the Boston area with his wife, they had two small children until his arrest and life in prison in 67, which brings us back to the time in 1967. He did escape with two fellow inmates from the Bridgewater State Hospital. He turned himself in, however, and then he was sent to a maximum security prison. He later recanted his strangler confessions. And on November 25th, 73, he was found stabbed to death in the prison infirmary. Robin Wilson, who was associated with the Winter Hell Gang, was tried for DeSalvo's murder, but the trial ended in a hung jury. F. Lee Bailey later claimed that DeSalvo was killed for selling amphetamines in the prison for less than the inmate enforced syndicate price. Okay, before we finish up this workout, let's go ahead and get in some of those DNA discoveries in more recent times. On July 11, 2013, Boston law enforcement officials announced the DNA evidence had linked DeSalvo definitively to the rape and murder of 19-year-old Mary Sullivan, and DNA test results proved DeSalvo was the source of seminal fluid recovered at the scene of Sullivan's 1964 murder. However, friends, this is where we get into the doubts, because though DeSalvo was conclusively linked to Mary Sullivan's murder, doubts continue to remain as to whether he committed all of the Boston Strangler homicides and whether another killer could still be at large. When he confessed, people who knew him personally did not believe him capable of the crimes. I don't know if that makes any sense, because we know people never know about what other people do behind closed doors. It's also noted that women allegedly killed by the Strangler were of widely varying ages, social status, and ethnicities. And again, as we've mentioned, that is usually really inconsistent with one serial killer. In 2000, Elaine Whitfield Sharp, an attorney specializing in forensic cases from Massachusetts, began representing the families of DeSalvo. A former print journalist, Sharp obtained court approval to exhume both Sullivan and DeSalvo for DNA testing. She went on to find, through her efforts, that there were several inconsistencies between DeSalvo's confessions and the crime scene evidence. Okay, friends, that's it. There, we could go on and on and on. I could probably do three more 60-minute long workouts to get into all of the inconsistencies that we learned throughout the Boston Strangler. But I'm going to leave it with this. While I usually like to wrap up my cases and workouts with a little lessons learned, we're going to do it a little bit different. So as you pull back, maybe you're even stretching it out a little bit as we've gone over our cool down time. Before Albert DeSalvo was actually killed, he wrote this poem in prison. He said, "Here is the story of the strangler yet untold, the man who claims he murdered 13 women, young and old. The elusive strangler, there he goes, where his wanderlust sends him, no one knows. He's struck within the light of day, leaving not one clue astray. Young and old, their lips are sealed, their secret of death never revealed. Even though he is sick in mind, he's much too clever for the police to find. To reveal his secret will bring him fame, but burden his family with unwanted shame. Today he sits in a prison cell, deep inside only a secret he can tell. People everywhere are still in doubt. Is the strangler in prison or roaming about?" So, friend, great workout. I want you to weigh in. Was it Albert? Did he take credit for all 13 due to his desire for fame and notoriety? Or was it the work of some copycat murders taking place? you be the judge and jury. Hit me up on the community page, Running Scared Podcast. I'll include that in episode notes, or you can email me at christine@runwinefinishlines.com. Thank you so much for joining me. And as always, thank you for Running Scared with Coach Christine.